My dearest sweet love, will you marry me? Before she could answer, the elephant let out another roar and then curled his trunk upward to grab something from Charlie's hand. The animal then extended its trunk toward Astrid, waving a red leather box in front of her face. Astrid took the box gingerly and opened it. Sparkling inside was a 5-carat canary diamond solitaire, encircled in a delicate floral scrollwork of white gold. It was an unusual setting, unlike anything that a contemporary jeweler might design. Wait a minute. This looks like my grandmother's engagement ring. It is your grandmother's engagement ring. But how? Astrid asked, utterly confused. I flew down to Singapore last month and had a secret date with your grandmother. I know how important she is to you, so I wanted to be sure we had her blessing. Astrid shook her head in disbelief as she stared at the precious heirloom ring, covering her mouth with her right hand as tears began streaming down her face. So how about it? Are you going to marry me? Charlie looked at her plaintively. Yes! Yes! Oh my God, yes! Astrid cried. Charlie got up and embraced her tightly as the crowd of dancers and musicians cheered. The two of them walked downstairs into the courtyard, and Shah Rukh Khan bounded toward them to be the first to offer his congratulations. Were you surprised? He asked.
My goodness, I'm still in shock. I didn't think I could still be surprised at this point in my life, but Charlie really pulled it off.
In the euphoria of the moment, no one noticed the series of bright flashes coming from the highest turret on the southern end of the fort. It came from the sunlight glinting off the telephoto lens of a Canon EOS 7D, the camera favored by paparazzi and private detectives. And it was pointed straight at Astrid and Charlie. Part 2. I made my money the old-fashioned way. I was very nice to a wealthy relative right before he died. Malcolm Forbes. Chapter 1. London, England. Wandi Megaharto Widjawa was in London with her mother, Adeline Salim Megaharto, supposedly to watch her nephew, Christian, compete in a fencing tournament. But secretly, they were both there for their tri-annual visits to the clinic of Dr. Ben Stork on Harley Street, who was considered by the most discerning filler addicts to be the Michelangelo of Botox. So deft were his hands at plunging needles into fine lines, fragile cheekbones, and delicate nasolabial folds, even his patients with the thinnest skins never bruised. And so subtle was his artistry that every patient visiting his clinic departed with the guarantee that they would be able to close both eyelids completely should they ever choose to blink. Smiling, laughing, frowning, or arching of eyebrows is highly discouraged, though. As Wandi sat in the elegant Hollywood Regency-style waiting room of the clinic, in her floral-embroidered Simone Rocha dress, waiting for her mother to get her usual combo of Botox, Juvederm, Voluma, Bellatero Balance, Restylane Lift, and Juvederm Vobella injections, she paged through the latest issue of British Tattle. She always flipped to the back of the magazine first to look at the Spectator section, which featured party pictures from the only parties that mattered throughout the realm. She loved scrutinizing all the English socialites from head to toe. The women looked like either chic swans or unmade beds. There was no middle ground. This month's Spectator section was quite disappointing. Nothing but photos from the 21st birthday bash of yet another kid named Hugo, the launch party for yet another Simon Sebag Montefiore book, and some boring country wedding. She could never understand why all these aristocrats loved getting married in decrepit little English country churches when they could have the most lavish nuptials at Westminster Abbey or St. Paul's Cathedral. What Wandi doesn't know is that the only people who can be married in Westminster Abbey are members of the British royal family, order of the Bath members and their children, or anyone living in the Abbey's precincts. St. Paul's only allows weddings for members of the Order of St. Michael and St. George, the Order of the British Empire, holders of the British Empire Medal, and members of the Imperial Society of Knights Bachelor and their children, but not their grandchildren. Suddenly, Wandi's eyes zeroed in on the obligatory photo of the bride and groom. As was the custom with all the wedding shots in British Paddle, the couple was pictured posing underneath the stone archway of the modest rectory, festooned with a few anemic sprigs of roses, sporting painful grins as rice was being pelted at them. But the thing that stood out to Wandi was that the bride was Asian, and this immediately triggered an alert. Wandi was part of a particular breed of chindocrat. Chinese plus Indonesian times aristocrat equals chindocrat. That had been raised in a very specific manner. The only daughter of an Indonesian Chinese oligarch, she was a typical third culture kid who had grown up all over the world. Born in Honolulu for the American passport, her early childhood was divided between her family's hospital wing-size house in Singapore and the historic family Joglo in Jakarta, where she attended kindergarten at the exclusive Jakarta International School, JIS. In the second grade, she was sent to the elite Singapore-American school, SAS, before an unfortunate fake Prada backpack trafficking incident in eighth grade led to her expulsion and swift enrollment into Aiglon, the boarding school of choice for privileged rebels in Shishiervillers, Switzerland. After Aiglon, Wandi spent 2 years majoring in marketing at the University of California at Santa Barbara before dropping out and marrying the son of another Indonesian Chinese oligarch, shuttling between homes in Singapore and Jakarta, having her baby at Kapiolani Medical Center in Honolulu, and going through the existential crisis of trying to decide whether to send her firstborn son to JIS, SAS, or ACS. She knew by age 3 that Hugo was too dumb to get into Raffles. Like most of the women who made up Asia's jet set, Wandi had an innate radar for OAWS. Other Asians in Western settings. Whenever she was traveling outside of Asia and happened to be, say, lunching at Tetsuya's in Sydney, attending the International Red Cross Ball in Monaco, or hanging out at 5 Hertford Street in London, and another person of Asian descent happened to enter the room, Wandi would notice that Asian well before any non-Asian did, and their face would immediately be run through the 10-point social placement scanner in her brain. 1. What kind of Asian is this? In descending order of importance, Chindo, Singaporean, Hong Konger, Malaysian Chinese, Eurasian, Asian American living in New York or Los Angeles, Asian American working in private equity in Connecticut, Canadian Asian from Vancouver or Toronto, Australian Chinese from Sydney or Melbourne, Thai, Filipino from Forbes Park, American-born Chinese, Taiwanese, Korean, mainland Chinese, common Indonesian. If they happen to be Japanese, Vietnamese, or any other type of Asian not mentioned on this list, abort scanner function. Totally inconsequential. 2. Do I know this OAWS? Specifically, is this a famous actor, pop singer, politician, social figure, social media star, doctor, celebrity without portfolio, billionaire, magazine editor? Add 50 points if royalty or Joe Taslim. If Joe Taslim, have bodyguards slip him my room key. 3. Do I know any members of this OAWS's family? Have I met, attended school, socialized, shopped, co-chaired a gala, blown, backstabbed anyone related to this person? 4. How much is this OAWS or his, her, family worth? Evaluate actual net worth against published net worth. Add 25 points if they have a family office, 50 points if they have a family foundation, 75 points if they have a family museum. 5. Have there been any juicy scandals in this OAWS or their family's past? Add 100 points if it involved bringing down an elected official, political party, or BFF at the Olivier Cafe in the Grand Indonesia Mall. 6. Does this OAWS or their family happen to own some fabulous hotel, airline, spa resort, luxury brand, restaurant, bar, nightclub that I could potentially benefit from? Add 25 points if family owns a private island. 500 points for a major movie studio. 7. How attractive and stylish is this OAWS in relation to me? Body scan assessment in this order. For ladies, face, skin whiteness, physique, jewelry, watch, handbag, shoes, outfit, hairstyle, makeup. Subtract 50 points if any gauche brands are visible, or for an obvious cosmetic procedure. For gentlemen, hair density, watch, shoes, physique, rest of outfit. Subtract 100 points if wearing an Hermes H-buckle belt, which only looks good on French or Italian men with deep tans and or titles. 8. How attractive, well-dressed, important, or famous are the white people that this OAWS is with? Subtract 20 points if it's a business occasion with Americans in corporate attire. Add 25 points if European. Add 50 points if French or Italian with deep tans and or titles. 9. How many bodyguards in this OAWS security detail? Evaluate intimidation level of bodyguards, factoring in muscle mass, uniforms, any visible weaponry, quality of earpieces, type of sunglasses, and how noticeable they are in the current space. The more they look like trigger-happy brick shit houses, ready to unleash their 6 hours on the dinner crowd at Nobu Malibu, the better. 10. When was this OAWS or their family last profiled in their local edition of Tattle, Pinnacle, or Town and Country? Add 100 points if they've never appeared in any magazines, but you still recognize them. At this point in her life, Wandi's social placement test was so finely calibrated it could evaluate a new Asian face in a matter of nanoseconds, thus determining to what degree Wandi felt prettier, richer, or more important than this OAWS, and what appropriate overture she felt comfortable making. Whether it be stealth eye contact, a nod of recognition, the slight smile, or actually greeting the person in close physical proximity. Of course, at the present moment, the OAWS in question only appeared in a rectangular 2x3-inch photograph. But it was so highly unusual for an Asian face to appear in this setting. An English country wedding worthy of being featured in the spectator section of British Tattle that Wandi couldn't help but take notice. The text block in the middle of the page simply read, Winter Wedding Wonderland. The unexpected snowfall didn't deter England's grandest from dusting off their furs and braving the icy roads for the wedding of Lucian Montague Scott at St. Mary's, Chipping Norton. Naturally, the Glencoras were out in full force along with the Devonshires, the Buccleuch, and a smattering of Rothschilds and Rochambeaus from both sides of the channel. Many a girl mourned that Lucian, a.k.a. Tall Drink of Water, was off the market, but no one could fault the bride, Colette Bing, whose porcelain doll complexion and ravishing smile could warm all the frigid chapels in the home counties put together. Wandi couldn't believe her eyes as she stared at the picture of the couple again. There was no way the bride, in the simple, almost monastic, high-necked wedding gown, was the same Colette Bing she had seen splashed over all of Asia's tabloids. What happened to the signature swath of black eyeliner and her matador red lipstick? This girl's face bore no evident traces of makeup, her lips ghostly pale. Where was the spectacular gold Gian Battista Valli dress that she had commissioned for her wedding? And most important, why wasn't she wearing some glittering tiara? Wandi dug into her Mark Cross white python handbag for her phone, quickly snapped a photo of the page and sent it via WhatsApp to Georgina Ting, who was at the very moment lounging poolside at the American Club in Singapore, not watching her daughter splash around in the deep end of the pool. Wandi Megaharto Wijawa.
Check this out!
Georgina Ting.
Badly dressed Brits?
WMW.
No, check out the bride.
GT.
OMFG. Where did you find this?
WMW.
British tattle. GT.
Colette's wedding was in British tattle? Wow, she really hit the holy grail. Did you send to Kitty?
WMW.
No, I didn't want to be the one to upset her.
GT.
Good thinking. Messenger always gets blamed. You don't want to risk losing your spa privileges on her plane.
WMW. At least with me, what you see is what you get. If I'm being a bitch, you know it's because I hate you.
Kitty is so unpredictable.
You remember what happened at Gian Battista Valli's atelier in Paris?
She was so calm and collected, and then suddenly she attacked Colette's wedding dress.
GT.
Yeah, no wonder she didn't wear it. They probably couldn't repair it in time.
WMW.
Still, I can't believe the dress she chose instead.
What the hell? She looks like Fräulein Maria at the convent.
She's unrecognizable.
Do you think she had her face rearranged in Seoul, or Buenos Aires, or London?
GT.
I think that's just how she looks with no makeup. I know that style. She's going for the posh Brit look now. They all want to look like freshly exfoliated virgins on their wedding day.
WMW.
This guy she married looks like a true blue blood.
GT.
I thought he was some science nerd.
WMW. No. Lawyer.
GT. Didn't you Google him when we were all in Paris?
WMW.
Tatiana did.
GT.
Has Tatiana seen this?
WMW. Not yet.
GT. Give me a sec.
Georgina forwarded the photo on to Tatiana Savarin and then started doing a bit of Googling on her own. A few moments later, Tatiana, who was holidaying on the island of Mustique, answered back. Tatiana Savarin.
That's who Colette Bing married?
WMW. Can you believe it?
TS.
Hottie McHot Pocket. Doesn't look like a boring suit at all.
GT.
Tatiana, you suck as a private eye. I just did some Googling and look what I found. Check out this link, ladies.
From rankmypeer.co.uk. Lord Lucien Plantagenet Montague Scott, Earl of Palliser, is the eldest son of the Duke of Glencora. In 2013, Tattle listed him as one of the 10 most eligible bachelors in Britain. According to the Sunday Times Rich List, the Duke of Glencora is the fifth largest landowner in England with holdings in Northamptonshire, Suffolk, and Scotland. But the crown jewels of their portfolio are vast property holdings in central London. Next to the Dukes of Westminster and Portland, the Glencoras are London's leading landlords, owning huge swathes of prime Bloomsbury and Chelsea. Furthermore, Lucien's mother, Lillian, hails from the French Rochambeau. C'est formidable.
T.S. This must be new. It didn't pop up when I did a search on him.
WMW. Holy fuck.
GT. Colette, the future Duchess of Glencora? Kitty's going to shit gold bricks if she finds out about this.
T.S. What do you mean if? I just sent everything to her?
GT.
You what?
Suddenly, all three women's phones started buzzing as a group call was being initiated from a Shanghai number. WMW.
That's Kitty calling.
T.S., should we pick up? She can see that we're all on a group chat.
Tatiana, you silly bitch.
Georgina muttered under her breath as she swiped her phone to initiate the group call.
Hi, Kitty, Wandi said in an overly cheery pitch. Hi, everyone. What's this you sent me?
Kitty asked.
Did you look at the picture or look at the link I just sent? Check out the photo. Don't bother looking at the other links.
Tatiana piped in urgently. There was a brief pause while Kitty scrutinized the picture on the screen of her phone. What am I supposed to be looking at? There's a bunch of gray-haired women with yellow teeth.
You don't see the bride? Wandi asked.
No.
Georgina cut in.
Kitty, scroll down to the bottom of the page. Do you see the image of the bride and groom?
There was silence for a few moments as the girls all held their breath, not knowing how Kitty would react.
How interesting,
Kitty finally said in a frighteningly neutral tone. Colette looks awful, doesn't she? Without her usual makeup and jewelry, she's such a plain Jane. Her common features really come out. Wandi sniggered.
She looks like she's fallen on hard times,
Tatiana remarked. Kitty let out a little laugh.
I can assure you, Colette hasn't fallen on hard times. She's just trying to appear modest to impress her new relatives. They look like the sort of people Karina Kotang is always trying to introduce me to. Well, good luck to her and her new English life.
Georgina was relieved that Kitty was taking it all so well. She was crossing her fingers, hoping to God that Kitty had completely missed the articles about the bridegroom when Kitty suddenly asked,
So, do we know anything about the Rochambeaus?
Damn, she's read everything, Wandi said to herself.
I've never heard of them, Georgina sniffed. Hey, I'm at this house party on Mustique right now, and there's a girl here who might know,
Tatiana offered, adding rather unnecessarily,
She comes from a high society family in France, from what I'm told.
Tatiana padded out onto the terrace of the Balinese-style villa where the girlfriend of her husband's business partner sat sipping black coffee out of a bowl.
Luci, I'm on the phone with some friends. Have you ever heard of a family in France called the Rochambeaus?
Which branch? Luci asked.
I don't know. We know someone who married a guy whose mother is a Rochambeau. Here, let me put you on speakerphone. The mother's name is Lillian Rochambeau,
Georgina offered. Luci's eyes widened. Lillian de Rochambeau? Are you talking about the mother of Lucien Montague Scott?
Yes. Do you know him?
Tatiana asked excitedly. Luci shook her head with a sigh.
I don't know him personally, but my God, every girl in France was madly in love with him. I mean, he's a future duke. And his mother is one of the Britannia Rochambeaus, not the Paris branch that are the poorer cousins.
But who are the Rochambeaus? Georgina pressed on.
Oh, they are an ancien famille de la noblesse, how do you say? An ancient noble family that intermarried with the Bourbons, and their line goes back to Louis the 13th. The Paris branch has all the vineyards, you know, Chateau de Rochambeau. But the Britannia Rochambeaus owned one of the biggest military defense companies in France. They make all the submarines and ships for the French Navy.
So who's your friend that married Lucien?
Colette Bing.
But she's not our friend exactly,
Tatiana said awkwardly.
She's a socialite and fashion blogger from Shanghai that...
Wandi began.
She's a spoiled little cunt,
Kitty suddenly blurted out. Everyone was too shocked to speak at first. But Georgina tried to turn it into a joke.
Ha ha, yes, she's famous for that spoiled rant that went viral, isn't she, Kitty?
The line went silent for a few moments.
I think Kitty hung up,
Tatiana said. Chapter 2 Ranakpur, India. Sui placed her hand on the white marble pillar and with her fingers traced the intricate carving of a goddess, feeling every undulating curve of the figure, so cool to the touch. The entire pillar was carved with figures of dancing damsels from the ground all the way up to the soaring dome. Sui looked around the space and saw that she was surrounded in every direction by thousands of white pillars, so many of them that it was impossible to count. Actually, there are 1,444 pillars in the temple, which also boasts 29 halls and 80 domes in a 48,000-square-foot area. Built by a wealthy Jain businessman named Dharma Shah, construction of the temple began in 1446
and took more than 50 years to complete. If you are ever in Jodhpur, please do yourself a favor and head to this amazing place instead of wasting your time and money buying cashmere throws from charming merchants who claim they were hand-woven exclusively for Hermes or Itro or Kenzo in a nearby village that employs 800 women. They really weren't. And Richard Gere wasn't just there last week buying 100 scarves either. And every one of them had been sculpted with deities, animals, love scenes, war scenes, each one so painstakingly carved it looked more like lacework than stone. She could hardly believe how exquisite it was. Sui felt so grateful that the Maharani had arranged this trip for her to the Adinatha temple, hidden in the remote Aravali range between Jodhpur and Udaipur. As she followed the marble passageway, she felt as though she were walking into a dream, and around another corner of the temple, she came upon a beautiful tree growing in the middle of a serene stone courtyard. Underneath the tree was a young man in a simple saffron-colored robe picking up stray leaves. He glanced up for a moment and smiled at her. Sui smiled shyly back at him before walking into yet another breathtakingly carved vestibule, this one depicting a deity entwined with hundreds of snakes. "Excuse me. Do you speak English?" a voice behind her suddenly asked. Sui turned around and saw that it was the young man. This time she could see a faint gold dot painted in the middle of his forehead. "I do," she replied. "Are you from China?" "No. I am from the island of Singapore. It is in the Straits Settlements. Ah, yes, on the tip of Malaya. There are a few Jains in Singapore. Please allow me to introduce myself. My name is Jai, and I am a priest here. My grandfather is the high priest of this temple, and one day my father shall be high priest, and then it will pass on to me. But not for a long time. You are very fortunate. This is the most beautiful temple I have ever been to," Sui said. "May I offer you a blessing? I would be honored." The priest guided her along to a quiet corner of the temple that was open to the view. They sat on the steps of a marble altar and looked out at the undulating hills as a cool breeze blew into the chamber. The monk smiled at her again. "We do not often get visitors from Singapore at the temple. I noticed you when you first entered the temple with your chaperone, because you were so beautifully dressed. But when you smiled at me, I sensed a great sadness in you." Sui nodded, lowering her eyes. "I am away from my family, and my island is at war." "Yes, I have heard about the war spreading through southern Asia. I do not understand this war, but I sense that your sadness comes from a deeper place." He gazed intently at her, and Sui noticed for the first time that his irises had an almost bluish-gray tint to them. Suddenly, she found her eyes welling uncontrollably with tears. "My brother," Sui said, almost inaudibly, her throat choking up. "My elder brother has been missing for some time." She had told no one about this, and she wasn't sure why she was telling him now. She was about to reach into her purse for her handkerchief when the monk produced one seemingly out of nowhere. It was a silk scarf with a deep blue and purple paisley pattern, and it seemed incongruous with the rest of his austere appearance. Sui wiped away her tears and looked up at the priest, who suddenly appeared to be wearing wire-framed glasses just like the ones her brother wore. "Yes, your brother Alexander wants to tell you something. Would you like to hear his message?" Sui looked at him, not comprehending what he meant at first. Before she could answer, the priest began to unleash a torrent of Hokkien. 7, 8, 9, coming ashore. Bloody hell. There's too many of them. This won't work. This won't work at all. A chill ran down her spine. This was her brother's voice coming out of the priest's mouth. And he was muttering the same nonsensical things he had said when he had been deliriously ill.
What won't work? Ajit, tell me, what won't work?
Sui asked urgently.
I can't take that many. It's too dangerous. We have to move very quickly, and we can't fight back?
Ajit, slow down. Who's fighting back?
Sui wrung her hands in frustration, feeling them get sticky. When she looked down at the silk paisley handkerchief, she saw that it was covered in a strange web-like mucus mixed with blood. Suddenly, her brother stopped his incoherent ranting and spoke to her in a clear, lucid tone.
I think you know what to do now, Sui. Trust your instincts. This is the only way we can atone for all that our ancestors have done. You can never tell anyone, especially not father.
In an instant, she knew what her brother meant.
How am I going to do all this by myself?
I have no doubt in you, sister. You are the last hope now.
Are you awake? Mummy, are you awake?
Sui felt a hand on her shoulder, and suddenly she was no longer in that exquisite temple in Ranakpur. And the priest with the bluish eyes was gone. She found herself waking up in her bedroom at Tyersal Park, the morning sun glaring into her eyes.
Mummy? Are you awake? I've brought Bishop C to see you,
Victoria said chirply. Sui let out a low groan.
I think she may be in pain, Bishop C said.
Sui groaned again. This irritating daughter just interrupted me from one of the most vivid moments in my life. Ajit was speaking to me. Ajit was trying to tell me something, and now he's gone.
Let me call in the nurse,
Victoria said in a worried tone.
She's pumped so full of hydrocodone, she really shouldn't be feeling anything. They said there might be hallucinations, that's all.
I'm not in pain. You just woke me up so suddenly,
Sui muttered in frustration.
Well, Bishop C is here to say a prayer for you. Please, some water,
Sui said, her throat as usual feeling so parched in the morning.
Oh, yes, water. Now let me see. Bishop C, could you do me a favor and go into my mother's dressing room? There are some Venetian glasses on a tray beside her dressing table. Lovely hand-blown glasses with dolphin stems from a wonderful shop near the Danieli. Just bring me one of those.
Aya, there's a plastic cup right here.
Sui gestured to the bedside table.
Oh, silly me. I didn't see that. Bishop C, do you see a water carafe by that table behind you? There should be an insulated silver carafe with an Art Nouveau motif of Stephanotis flowers carved along the handle. Just get me the goddamn cup,
Sui said.
Oh, dear mummy. Language. Bishop C is in the room,
Victoria said, trying to hand over the cup.
Do you not see that my hands are tangled up in tubes? You need to help me sip the water from the straw,
Sui said in frustration. Here, do allow me. The bishop stepped in and took the cup from a frazzled Victoria.
Thank you,
Sui said gratefully, after she had taken a few precious sips.
Now, mummy, Bishop C and I were speaking earlier over breakfast, and I was reminded that you've never been baptized. The bishop has kindly brought with him a little vessel of holy water from the River Jordan, and I'm wondering if we might do a ritual baptism right here in this room.
No, I don't want to be baptized,
Sui said flatly.
But, mummy, do you not realize that until you are baptized, you can never enter the kingdom of heaven?
How many times do I have to tell you I am not a Christian?
Don't be silly, mummy. Of course you are. If you're not a Christian, you won't be able to go to heaven. Don't you want to be with Daddy? And all of us in the future that is eternity?
Sui could not think of a worse fate than to be trapped with a im jim, Cantonese for difficult, persnickety. Daughter, throughout all of eternity, she simply sighed, tired of having this conversation again. Mrs. Young, if I might ask, the bishop began gingerly, if you aren't a Christian, what do you consider yourself to be?
I respect every god, she replied softly.
Victoria rolled her eyes derisively.
My grandfather Shang Lung Ma's people were Buddhists, Taoists, Kuan Yin worshippers, all that mishmash of religions. You know, in that old-fashioned Chinese sort of way.
The bishop adjusted his collar, looking slightly uncomfortable.
Well, Victoria, we really can't force your mother to be baptized, but perhaps we can pray that she will allow Jesus Christ into her heart.
We have to let Jesus come into her softly, gently.
I don't need Jesus to come into me, Sui said agitatedly. I am not Christian. If I'm anything, I'm a Jain.
Mummy, what on earth are you talking about? What is a Jain? Are you confused and talking about your friend Jane Reitzman?
Victoria asked, looking up at the IV machine to make sure her mother wasn't being overdosed with some crazy opiate.
Jainism is an ancient religion that is an offshoot of Hinduism.
Actually, Bishop C is wrong about that. While Jains and Hindus agree on the concept of karma, the cycle of life and death, and some other aspects of emancipation, liberation, and release, they are two distinct and separate religions. Bishop C began to explain. Victoria stared at her mother in horror.
Hinduism?
You can't possibly be Hindu.
My goodness, our laundry maids are Hindu. Don't say you are a Hindu, Mummy. It would absolutely break my heart.
Sui shook her head wearily and pressed the buzzer in her right hand. Moments later, her lady's maids entered the room.
Madri, Patravadi, please show Victoria out, she ordered.
Victoria, come, we can say a prayer together outside, the bishop urged, glancing up at Sui's heart rate monitor nervously.
Mother, you can't just order me out of your room like this. Your soul is in peril,
Victoria shrieked as Alex entered the bedroom amid all the commotion. Sui glanced up at Alex pleadingly.
Please tell Victoria to leave. She is irritating me to death.
All right, then,
Victoria said in a quiet voice as she turned swiftly and stormed out of the bedroom.
Patravadi turned to Sui with an attentive smile.
Madam, your usual porridge this morning?
Yes, and tell them to put an egg in it today,
Sui instructed. As soon as her lady's maids left, Sui let out a long sigh.
She means well, Mummy,
Alex said diplomatically.
Why does she always have to be such a nuisance? And I can't stand that fat little Lan Jiaobin.
Hokkien, for dick face.
Si Bei Xian.
You know, he only wants money for his cathedral building fund. Victoria writes him so many checks every month, her account is always going into overdraft.
Victoria may have her irritating ways, but she has a good heart. She is the most generous person out of anyone I know.
Sui smiled at Alex.
And you are always the peacemaker. Even when you were a little girl, you were always the one to heal the rifts between your sisters. Will you be sure to keep the peace after I'm gone?
Of course, Mummy. But don't worry. Prof. Un assures me your heart is improving every day. Even Malcolm says he's so pleased with your progress.
That may be the case, but I know I can't live forever.
Alex didn't know what to say. She simply busied herself by straightening her mother's bedsheets and smoothing them out.
Alex, you don't have to be afraid for me.
I have no fear of death. You have no idea how many times I've stared it in the face. I just don't wish to be in any pain. That's all.
Prof. Un is making sure of that,
Alex said matter-of-factly. Alex, will you do me a favor? Will you call Freddy Tan and tell him to come over?
Freddy Tan? Your lawyer?
Alex asked, unnerved by the request.
Yes. It's very important that I see him as soon as possible. His number is in the address book on my dressing table.
Of course. I'll go and call him right now, Alex said.
Sui closed her eyes, attempting to relax for a moment. She was still trying to forget the look of hurt she had seen on Victoria's face after she had snapped at her.
Stupid girl.
The words came echoing back to her, from a memory far back in time.
You stupid, stupid girl,
her father had snarled angrily when Sui had appeared in the basement of the shop house at Telok Ayer Street. Do you know the fortune I spent? The number of favors I had to call in just to get you safely out of Singapore? Why are you here?
Did you think I could just sit in the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel while I got news every day about all the terrible things that were happening back here? All the bombings? All the people being tortured and killed?
Which is exactly why I got you out of Singapore, on the last frigate out.
I didn't know what was happening here, Pa. I got news about everyone else, Tan Kah Kee, Uncle SQ, Uncle Sai Kun, but there was never any news of you. When Chin Tuan came to India, he said he hadn't heard any news about you. That's when I thought you had been captured, or maybe even killed somewhere.
I told you you weren't going to hear from me. I told you I would be fine.
Fine? Look at you. Hiding in a hole in the ground, dressed in rags,
Sui said, tears in her eyes as she looked at her father in his stained singlet and trousers full of cigar ash. She had never seen her father out of his three-piece suit before. With his head shaved and his face smeared with dirt, he looked almost unrecognizable.
Silly girl, don't you see I'm dressed like this on purpose? The only way to survive is to be invisible. I made myself look like an illiterate dock worker. The Japanese soldiers don't even bother to spit in my direction. Now how the hell did you get back into the country without getting yourself raped or killed?
Sui gestured at the Thai silk dress she was wearing. I crossed from India to Burma on the train, and then came down through Bangkok as part of the Thai ambassador's entourage. I'm disguised as a lady's maid to Princess Narisara Banupakadi.
Shang Lu Ma let out a phlegmy laugh as he looked over his daughter. On the one hand, he was furious at her for coming back to a war-ravaged island, but on the other hand, he had to admire her resourcefulness. She knew how to be invisible, too, and she had proved herself braver than her brothers. What are we going to do with you, now that you're back?
It's too dangerous for you to go to Tyersal Park, you know,
he sighed.
I'm going back to Tyersal Park whether you like it or not. I'm going to stay there and do everything I can to help anyone who is suffering and in danger.
Sui's father scoffed.
The Japanese control everything now. Where on earth did you get such an idea that you could actually be of help?
A priest told me, Pa. A young priest at the most beautiful temple on earth.
Chapter 3 Singapore. In all his years of working for the Young family as the head of security, Captain Vikram Gale never had to deal with a situation quite like the one he now faced. Standing before him at the gates of Tyersal Park was Philip Young, the only son of Shang Su-yi.
This was the man who had interviewed and hired him for the job 32 years ago. And this was the man who should have been his future boss had he not foolishly incurred his mother's wrath 2 decades ago by inexplicably moving to Australia and losing his rightful inheritance of the house he had grown up in. Normally, Philip Young's hunter green Jaguar Van den Pla would have been waved through the gates without any hesitation. But the problem was the man sitting in the front passenger seat, Nicholas Young, whom Vikram had known since he was a little boy. Until about 5 years ago, Nicky was his grandmother's favorite and the presumptive heir of Tyersall Park. He was, for all intents and purposes, the young lord of the manor. But now Vikram was under the strictest of orders not to allow entry to Nicky. Vikram knew he had to handle the situation as diplomatically as possible. Knowing how mercurial his mistress, Shang Su-yi, could be, there was still a chance that she could change her mind at the last minute and reinstate Nicky or Philip as heir to the estate. For heaven's sake, Philip's initials formed the shape of the elaborate boxwood labyrinth in the gardens, and Nicky's bedroom was still left unoccupied and untouched, exactly as it had been the last time he stayed there. Either of these men could very soon be his boss, and he mustn't offend. "I'm so sorry, Mr. Young. You must see how my hands are tied. Please don't take this personally," Vikram said earnestly, casting an embarrassed smile at Nick.
"I understand. Tell me, who gave the orders?"
Philip's tone was polite, but his irritation was apparent.
Eleanor flung the car door open and climbed out angrily. "Vikram, what is all this nonsense? Don't tell me we can't go in."
"Mrs. Young, as I was just explaining to Mr. Young, you are both more than welcome to enter. But I am under strict orders not to allow entry to Nicky. I checked again after he first arrived the other night while I was off duty. They said no, absolutely not."
"Who are they? Who gave you the orders? Sui is a living vegetable right now. She couldn't have said a thing to you."
"Beg your pardon, Mrs. Young, but Mrs. Young is not a living vegetable," Vikram sputtered.
Nick rolled down the window. "Mum, Dad, why don't you both just go in and I'll..."
"Shut up, La!"
Eleanor waved her hand in front of Nick's face dismissively.
"Vikram, how much money have you made on my stock tips over the years? Sinolan, Keppel Corp, Silver Lake Axis.
I swear to God, I'm never going to give you a single tip again. I made you a rich man, and this is how you repay us? Mangkali kausai!"
Hokkien for Bengali dog shit. However, Eleanor is technically wrong in her swearing, since Vikram, being a Gurkha, is Nepali, not Bengali. But to her, there are only 2 types of Indians, rich ones like her friends the Singhs, and poor ones like everybody else. Vikram sighed as he tried to find a way out of this quagmire.
"Why don't I call up to the house again, and perhaps you can speak to Miss Victoria directly?"
Philip had reached the end of his patience.
"No, Vikram, I've had enough of this. This is my house too, and I will not take orders from my little sister. If my mother does not want to see Nicky, she can tell me herself. He won't go into her room unless he's asked for. But I will not have my son waiting by the gates like some sort of beggar. Call up to the house if you want to, but we are all going in."
Philip returned to the driver's seat and revved the engine. Vikram stood in front of the gray wrought iron gates with his arms crossed as Philip inched the sedan slowly toward the gates until the front bumper was almost touching the imposing guard's knees. The other guards stood by, not sure what to do.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Vikram counted in his head. Have I let this go on long enough? Philip was a decent fellow, and he knew he wouldn't get in trouble with him. As far as he was concerned, there was no real security risk to letting the 3 of them in. It was just a family quarrel, and now that he had done his duty and put on a good show, he was going to get out of the way. He sidestepped the car in 1 easy stride and ordered his men.
Open the gates.
Philip jammed his foot on the pedal angrily and zoomed up the gravel driveway at top speed. As the road curved toward the main approach to the house, the most curious sight unfolded before them. Assembled on the front lawn were several rows of wrought iron chairs shaded by colorful silk parasols. Most of the family members staying at Tyersall Park, Victoria Young, the Akaras, and the Chings, were seated watching a doubles badminton match along with a few invited guests like Bishop Sibe Sien, Rosemary Sien, and the Thai ambassador. Behind the seats, an elaborate ice cream bar had been set up alongside a table dominated by an immense crystal punch bowl brimming with icy fruit punch. Eleanor shook her head disparagingly.
So shameful. Your mother lies on her deathbed while everyone is outside having a garden party.
What are they supposed to do?
Kneel all day by her bedside and chant prayers?
Philip asked.
Well, the bishop is here. At the very least, he should be inside praying for her instead of eating an ice cream sundae.
Mummy detests that man.
The only reason he's here is because Victoria is still infatuated with him. She's been like this since their NUS days.
National University of Singapore.
Oh my God, how come I never knew this? This explains why she's always so bitchy toward Mrs. C.
Mum, haven't you noticed that Auntie Victoria is a bitch to anyone who doesn't have a doctorate in divinity?
Nick chuckled. As the Jaguar pulled up to the circular driveway in front of the house, Nick could see Eddie Ching and his brother Alistair battling it out with Uncle Toxin and Adam Akara. Toxin, Adam, and Alistair were casually dressed in shorts and polo tees, but Eddie was dressed completely in white, from his long-sleeved white linen shirt and white linen pleated trousers to his white lace-up wingtips. Nick chuckled as he noticed that Eddie's wife, Fiona, and their three children were also sweating away under the afternoon sun in white linen outfits with beige cashmere sweaters tied around their shoulders, no doubt at Eddie's behest. As Philip, Eleanor, and Nick emerged from their car, the match came to an abrupt halt as the group assembled on the lawn stared at the new arrivals. For a moment, Nick wondered if his relatives were going to treat him differently, now that he had been officially banished from Tyersall Park. His cousin Alistair dropped his racket and bounded over immediately.
"So glad you're here, man,"
he said, giving Nick a big hug. Nick smiled in relief. He could always count on good old Alistair. Following behind him came Catherine. Of the four young sisters, she was the one who had always been closest to Nick's father, since they were barely 2 years apart in age and had been sent away to boarding school in England together.
Koko,
Cantonese for brother,
she said warmly, giving Philip a quick peck on the cheek.
Did you just get in?
Hi, Cat. I arrived earlier this morning. Is the whole family here?
Just Tuck, Adam, and Pia for the time being. The other boys are making plans to come down.
I see. It's Thailand versus Hong Kong. What's the score?
5-2, advantage Thailand.
Eddie suggested the match, but he's not carrying his own weight. Alistair's admirably trying to hold up his end, but I don't think he realizes that Tuck used to play on the Thai Olympic team.
Bloody hell! No wonder he's kicking my ass.
Alistair groaned. Catherine gave Eleanor a kiss before glancing over at Nick.
It's good to see you, Nicky. Been far too long. Is Rachel not here with you?
I can't believe I still haven't met her.
No, it's just me, Nick said, giving his aunt a hug.
Catherine looked into his eyes, wanting to say something, but Victoria marched up to their little cluster before she could continue.
Coco,
Victoria nodded curtly at her brother while fanning herself furiously with a carved wooden fan. Then she glanced at Nick and said,
I'm afraid you can't come into the house. Please don't take this personally.
How am I supposed to take it then?
Nick said with a wry smile.
Eleanor spoke up.
This is ridiculous. Why can't Nicky go into the house? He just wants a chance to say he's sorry to Mummy.
Victoria winced visibly. Even after 4 decades, she had never gotten used to her sister-in-law calling her mother, Mummy.
Eleanor, tell me what I'm supposed to do.
You of all people should know what my mother is like. I'm just following her wishes.
Philip looked at his sister skeptically.
Mum specifically told you she didn't want to see Nick?
Actually, she told Eddie.
Eddie? My goodness, you actually believe him? Eddie has been jealous of Nicky since they were children.
Eleanor scoffed. Hearing his name come up among the chatter, Eddie sauntered over to the group.
Uncle Philip, Auntie Elle, let me be very frank. 3 days ago when I was with Amma in her bedroom, I told her that Nicky was on his way home. I thought it would soothe her to know that he was coming to make amends. But instead, she got so upset that she went into cardiac arrest. Auntie Victoria was right there when it happened. We almost lost her that day.
Well, that was 3 days ago. I'm going up to see my mother now. She can tell me to my face if she doesn't wish to see Nicky.
Philip insisted.
You're really going to put Amma's life at risk again?
Eddie said. Philip stared contemptuously at his nephew, who was drenched in sweat, his clammy skin showing through in large blotches on the most unflattering areas of his white outfit. What a ridiculous boy he was, all dressed up like he was playing in a cricket match at Lord's. He didn't trust him for 1 second.
Eddie, let me worry about my mother. Perhaps you should be more concerned about your own children at the moment.
What do you mean?
Eddie swung around and saw his children standing by the ice cream bar with their cousin Jake Moncur. Constantine, Augustine, and Calliste were happily licking away at cones topped with double scoops of ice cream, oblivious to the ice cream melting down their hands and dripping all over their white linen outfits. Eddie broke into a sprint toward them as he began screaming,
Fiona, look what the kids are doing! I told them no ice cream in their Brunello Cucinelli linens!
Fiona Tongcheng, who was huddled in conversation with Pia Akara and Cecilia Cheng Moncur, looked up for a brief moment. She rolled her eyes and went right back to talking with the ladies. With Eddie urgently marching his three children off in search of Ah Ling and the head laundress, Nick took his place in the badminton game while his parents went into the house with Victoria.
She's really not supposed to have any more visitors today, Victoria muttered as she led Philip and Eleanor down the corridor towards Sui's bedroom come hospital suite.
I'm not a visitor. I'm her son, Philip shot back in annoyance.
Victoria fumed silently to herself. Yes, I know you are her son, her only son. Mummy's made this abundantly clear to me my entire life. Her precious only son gets special bird's nest soup prepared for him every week all through his childhood, while we girls only get it on our birthdays. Her only son has all his clothes tailor-made on Savile Row, while we have to sew our own dresses. Her only son gets his own Jaguar convertible the minute he returns from university, while the girls have to share one miserable Morris Minor. Her only son gets to marry whomever he wants, no matter how common she is, while every man I ever bring home is deemed unsuitable. Her only son abandons her to live out his Crocodile Dundee fantasies in Australia, while I'm forced to stay here and take care of her in her old age. Her precious only son. When they arrived at her mother's sitting room, Victoria started interrogating the nurses while Philip and Eleanor went into the bedroom. Alex was sitting in the armchair by her mother's bedside when they entered.
Oh, Coco, you're here. Mummy's just fallen asleep. Her blood pressure was fluctuating too wildly, so they gave her a sedative.
Philip looked down at his mother, suddenly shocked by her appearance. When he had last seen her at Christmas, barely 5 weeks ago, she was still climbing on the ladder to the top of her star fruit trees. But now she seemed so small in the hospital bed, so lost in the tangle of tubes and machines surrounding her. All his life she had seemed so strong, so invincible. He couldn't even begin to fathom the possibility of her not being around.
I think I'll spend the night here with Mom, he said in a quiet voice.
There's really no point. She's going to sleep right through the night. And besides, her lady's maids take turns to be with her all night long in case she wakes up. The nurses also come in to check on her every half hour. Come back tomorrow. She's usually conscious for a few hours in the morning, Alex said.
It doesn't matter if she's asleep.